morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone.
Is Mike Cosentino, and this is the no Trump zone for a few minutes. We're doing on Democratic Perspective this morning. We're trying to avoid Donald Trump because in American news, it's Donald Trump all the time. We got a Mideast expert with us, and there's still other stuff in the world. Isn't there some other stuff going on in the world besides Trump's trips to Florida and all this other crapola? So Steve came up with this idea of having a show on the Middle East.
We have a Professor Paul Lenz here, who's an expert on the Middle East, and particularly on, he's written a book on military and civilian relations in the Middle East, which if you follow, say, what happens in Egypt or something, is what's the name of your book, Paul?
It's called Civil-Military Relations in the Islamic World. It examines the relationship that the militaries of each of these countries have with politicians and why the military often got involved in politics beginning in the Cold War after the end of colonialism in the Middle East.
And then you've signed for a new book on Syrian refugees?
Yes. My colleague at Texas A&M and I will be writing a book about the European Union's response to the Syrian refugee crisis and whether or not the migration issue and infectious diseases are going to impact Europe over the course of the next few years.
It is one of the great crises now, is the Syrian refugee crisis. The U.S. takes almost no Syrian refugees. Germany took 1 million. There have been problems in Sweden, took so many people, the highest per capita refugees in the world. It's not just from Syria, but from all over the Middle East where there's chaos and famine and what's your take on that? I mean, what should the European response to all of this be?
And Paul, I love statistics, so don't be afraid of stats. On NPR this morning, was that the U.S. lets in 800 or 900 refugees a week. It's about 65,000 a year. Certainly not Syrian refugees. That's refugees total. The old policy was 110,000 a year. And Trump has proposed, I believe, it was 50,000 a year. So these are the numbers, at least, quote-unquote, of refugees on the U.S. side. But the need and what Europe is dealing with is massive, isn't it?
So how many refugees are there, for example? I mean, no, we don't know exactly. We're talking how many, you think?
Well, I've seen numbers on the orders of millions of refugees.
Yes, that's what I've seen.
You know, that since 2000, I believe it was since 2014, there's been on the order of close to 50 million refugees.
50 million.
That was the last number that I saw.
I get it.
Wow.
But to answer your question, Steve, about the importance of the Syrian refugee crisis, I think, is one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes of our time. You know, you have frontline states in Eastern Europe, many of which were led by and have been led by populist far-right nationalist parties that view these immigrants as terrorists, or they view them as taking away from jobs. You know, similar arguments that you see here from 45's administration. And so because of that, you have these states that are saying, we don't want to take them, but you have the old Europe, like France, Germany, willing to take in refugees. You know, so it's what it's created is a conflict between liberalism and populism. You know, and it's going to be a challenge for democracy, I think, over the course of the next few years, whether or not these frontline states are actually willing to shoulder the burden and taking in and allowing these refugees to come. And their main argument is that they can't fund it, that they don't have the money.
The social benefits are so generous that that you've got to think, if you're in Sweden, if you arrive there as a refugee, I mean, they really take care of you. I mean, you really go into the system and you have support until you have a job and you have support for your family and you have free medical care and all this stuff. It's got to be attractive. Who is fleeing Syria? Syria is made up of Sunni Muslims, majority, Shiite Muslim minority, Druze, Christians.
Kurds as well.
Kurds. Is everyone fleeing, and are they fleeing now mostly through Turkey, or are they going out by the ocean?
There are many. I saw a number just recently of about 8 million internally displaced within Syria. So they've fled through Turkey, but they've also gone to Jordan and to Lebanon. Jordan and Lebanon have actually taken on the bulk of the refugees from Syria, and many of them are fleeing because the camps in Jordan, the camps in Lebanon, are becoming overcrowded. There's no room for them anymore, and so they're trying to flee through the Mediterranean to places like Greece and to Italy. And so what the European Union has done is they've established camps where they begin to screen these refugees and allow them to begin the process of asylum.
So is it everyone fleeing? All of majority, minority groups fleeing, or is it concentrated? Okay, so you're a Shiite, you're living in a village. The village gets sort of overrun by Sunnis, then you're an internal refugee, right? And the same is true if you're Sunni. If you're Shiites overrun your village, you're an internal refugee. There's 8 million of these people bouncing around trying to figure out where to go. I mean, we see these horrible pictures of what's happening.
Right. And the destruction of infrastructure within many of these cities.
So, What can be done? I mean, the United States is sort of standing off from all this and letting the Europeans bear the brunt of it. And as you said, it's the largest humanitarian crisis probably in decades.
You know, I think there needs to be, there's a number of different steps that need to be done. First, the international community, the United States and the Russians, need to stop funding their various proxies and begin to work with the United Nations. What this shows me is that there's a lack of trust in the United Nations to want to solve this issue, that they're more concerned about power and influence than they are about the humanitarian aspect of this crisis. So, number one, you solve the Syrian refugee crisis by creating the conditions to allow for peace talks to occur in Syria, and whether that has Assad coming in and staying in power,
right.
that's going to be on the table because of the Russian influence,
right.
And the fact that...
And that's what you mean by their proxies.
Exactly.
That Assad being the Russian proxy and various proxies of the United States.
Sorry for talking so wonky. The school year just ended.
The tremendous amount of foreign intervention into Syria, and so you have Iran siding with Assad, Russia siding with the Assad government, and then you have the Americans and the Saudis and the Emirates and the Turks all supporting the rebels, and you have all these different ethnic groups. So if you wanted to design a giant, horrible mess, you could barely do better than Syria.
Who's on our side over there?
Who's on our side? On our side, we have the YPJ, which are the Syrian Kurds.
Kurds, okay.
In the northeastern part of the country who are fighting. Turkey was on our side for a while. They seem to be on the fence right now.
Turkey's a big deal. Let's stop for a minute and talk about that, because U.S. has so many resources there. They've been an ally for so long, as you pointed out before the show, a NATO ally. And we have bases there. I mean, I know people that serve there, and still there's... So there's a lot of... So it seems like... I don't know. Is it something the U.S. has done to mess with a friend? Because we do that, as you know. Or is it just something that their internal politics have taken them in a direction that seems not perhaps to support U.S. interests?
I think it's more of the internal politics of Recep Erdogan is a wolf in sheep's clothing. You know, that's how he came to power. He was his major support in the Justice and Development Party. That's the party that he created. And won its first election back in 2002, he comes to power with support from the countryside, right. Which large Muslim country, the countryside is heavily religious. Right. And they got behind Erdogan. So once his party was in power, he slowly but surely took steps to try and consolidate his power within the institutions to build his support. And once he did that, you know, he now has this referendum that just passed recently where it gives him that even more authority. So for him, it was about power.
More Islamic, less secular.
Right, exactly.
And more about him and his control. It's like Putin gaining more and more power. He's gained more and more power and concentrated it in his hand. There was an attempted coup, right?
Right,
gave
yes.
him a justification.
July of last year.
Yeah. And that gave him a justification to fire and imprison thousands of people. We're talking about professors and judges and media. He's closed down almost all the media outlets. We were talking about the about this before the show. We had a professor, a Turkish professor, who was going to come on and the show by long distance and talk about Syrian refugees. And after the coup and the crackdown, the guy was afraid to come on the show.
Yeah.
So that, I think that, you know, you see one thing like that, that must be multiplied by thousands of times.
Yeah, and I had heard stories that the government of Erdogan would go after the families of these professors and these poets and anybody who was criticizing the government. They were using that as free rein to go after their families.
So Turkey is a traditional U.S. ally. It's a member of NATO. But it seems to be going absolutely south in terms of being a democracy and becoming a sort of a one-man state. And it, what happens when you purge so much of the intellectual and military elite of the country? Is it going to be right now? I guess he's got all the cards in his hands, Erdogan, but is it stable situation, and what's the impact on our relationship with him? As he's going to be coming, I think, next week to talk to President Trump.
Yes. No, I think a lot of it will have to do with the economic relationship that Turkey has with the United States. I think that's still going to influence a lot of the decision making that Erdogan.
You mean the number of Trump hotels in Istanbul?
Potentially.
It's clear what we mean by economy these days.
Sure, but even think long term, you know, Turkey is reliant upon its relationship with the European Union, with the economic relationship. The United States is still a major trading partner. We are a member of NATO with them, you know, and so there is still a reliance from Turkey upon the security umbrella of the United States. They still rely upon us for protection.
So a while back, people were talking about Turkey had no enemies. It had friends everywhere. The economy was expanding. Their foreign relations was going well. And now it's gotten worse and worse. They've become more isolated. They seem to be at odds with the U.S. The U.S. is supporting, I guess I don't know what Paul would agree, but according to reports, the best fighters against ISIS and stuff in northern Syria are Kurdish political party that Erdogan and the Turks hate because they don't want folks. The thing is that, you know, when nation states got divided up, some guys get on the short end of the stick, and the Kurds are scattered between Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and even Iran. And they're a distinctive people with their own culture, their own language, their own style of dressing, everything. And yet they didn't end up with a state. And that's caused problems ever since for decades. So what should the U.S. policy be? I mean, basically, President Trump carried out President Obama's plans to arm the Syrian Kurds, because there's no alternative to that and taking out the last big remaining capital of that ISIS has.
Right. And so that's the main goal of the Trump administration, is to go after ISIS. You know, counterterrorism was the thing that he campaigned on and said he was going to continue. I like to call what Trump is doing as the anti-Obama doctrine.
Yes. You know,
in the study of U.S. foreign policy, they always talk about every president having a doctrine. The Bush doctrine was about preemption, for example. You know, let's go after the terrorists before they attack us, and then nation building. But for Trump, what I see him doing is carrying out, although he calls it the anti-Obama doctrine, or I'm calling it the anti-Obama doctrine. It's actually very similar to, like you were saying, Steve, about what Obama was doing. He's sending money and weapons to the Kurds to help them fight. We have special forces in there helping to fight and train the Iraqi army and Iraqi national police. You know, and so I see what we have to do is we go after ISIS, but we have to work with not only the Kurds, but the Iraqis and truly try and get them to see how serious this is and have a stake in the game. I think the politicians, there's a lack of leadership in a number of these Arab states in the Middle East, and that they're not willing to actually put forward the money, the resources to actually.
And by the way, just to step back, that's the environment that terrorists thrive in. The more chaos, the more unstable.
Mm-hmm.
ISIS, ISIL. Whatever we're talking about Islamic State in Syria, we talk about Islamic State in Lebanon, and we're talking about other fundamental movements, I guess, in the Middle East.
So Islamic State is about to lose their last large city in Iraq. What do you think would be the implications of that? It's been, I think, the Iraqis invaded about 7 months ago to try to drive them out of Mosul. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think it'll be a huge victory for the country of Iraq that they were able to do this with the assistance of the United
and
States.
And the stability of Iraq.
And the stability of Iraq. And what I think will happen is you'll see some of these fighters dissolve. They'll probably go back into Syria and try and cause trouble there. But once Islamic State is defeated, there will be another group that shows up. As long as there's this continued instability, call it what you will, there will still be Islamic fundamentalism there because of their hatred towards the West and their hatred towards democracy and what it means for people.
Well, you know, I was reading a history of the Arabs and the treatment of the colonial powers of Arab people was pretty much amazing. They would loan the government of Egypt, say we're talking about 150 years ago, a ton of money, and then more money than the Egyptian government could pay back. And then when the Egyptian money, the government went into default, then they would take over. And they did this over and over again. Some of the treaties they negotiated with the Emirates and stuff, astonishing in their rapaciousness. Is that the right word? So there's a lot of bad blood. I think that Americans have no idea. And we weren't really much participants in the colonial struggle in the Arab world that has always given anti-Western stuff a sort of legitimacy.
Well, yes, but also during the Cold War, though, we continued those colonial policies, de facto by supporting, the Saudis against the Iranians. We had economic and political stakes in what was happening there.
We're talking to Paul Enns. I get your last name right?
Yeah.
Talking to Paul Enns, political science and a professor from Northern Arizona University and a Middle East knowledgeable guy. So is the U.S. going to, from that standpoint, is the U.S. going to make a deal with Russia? Are we going to solve some of these things by making a deal with our traditional Cold War enemy? Is there, when you guys sit around the Middle East professors club, did you guys talk about, what's happening behind the scenes here? Who's making the deals?
Well, that's actually a very good question because I really don't know that answer.
All right.
Because it's hard to say with what Trump is doing, because on one hand, he'll bluster and he'll launch, I believe it was 53 or 56 right. Tomahawk missiles. 59. 59 missiles, at the Syrian airbase because of the chemical weapons use. And that was part of that anti-Obama doctrine, because he wanted to show that he was strong-willed and would stand up to these type of dictators.
Right.
Yet he also meets, was it either yesterday or the day before, with Sergey Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, doesn't allow any American media into this meeting, but allows Russian media to come in and videotape this meeting. So it's hard to say what his actual goal is.
And isn't that where the danger lies? Because it's so unclear, at least according to Foreign Policy magazine, that not knowing, the absence of a policy for the U.S. is not good.
The argument that I see in foreign policy is that some of the writers for it hope for a more what they would call a realist view of foreign policy. That
sure.
is a much no more nation building, no more interfering in a country. I suppose if you took it to extreme, even if there's a humanitarian problem, if it's not in the interest of the United States. And they looked at Trump sort of beginning to spout a doctrine sort of like that, except that it's basically amateur hour. You don't know what the policy is from one day to another. And you don't know. I mean, he's done some astonishing things, and unpredictable things. For instance, telling the Navy they can't have their catapults that just seem kind of off the wall. So it is hard to understand what the Trump policy actually is in all this.
Well, I think just from what I've seen in the last few months, it could be, you know, almost a neo-realist type foreign policy, which is what they call offshore balancing, where essentially the United States is the major global power that, you know, has, you know, the largest navy in the world that can project power, but we stand offshore from a region, and we pick and choose our allies, and we allow them
right.
to do the fighting for us, or to do the negotiating for us, and then if there's a major problem, then we as the large power will come in and try and stabilize the situation. Because mainly what's happening in the Middle East is that's all we want, is we just want to create stability so that our allies can maintain their power and we can maintain power and influence within the region.
So we helped break Syria, right?
Yes.
How can it be put together again? These people, I mean, once people start shooting and killing each other, and maybe they lived in peace for decades or even hundreds of years next to each other, but once they divide off into tribes and start killing each other, how do you put things back together again? Or can you put Syria back together again? Can you even help the Syrians do it?
Well, I think a lot of it will have to be done locally, you know, because these were neighbors that were killing each other, you know, so there will have to be the desire at the local level for these individuals to want to bring peace. What we can do as America is we can help with Russia create the conditions that would make that possible, which would be, number one, go after ISIS, you know, so that way there aren't these safe havens for terrorists to train and then attack our allies, but help Iraq become a stronger state than it is. And then decide if the United States, as a major actor, wants to work with Russia and bring together all of the combatants in the Syrian civil war, have them sit down and see if they're willing to talk. There's been, over the last 4 to 5 years, there's been at least 3 or 4, maybe 5 instances where the international community has tried to get together or bring all of the parties together to talk. But there's so much disagreement and animosity between each of the various parties that even the Free Syrian Army was part of a larger Free Syrian movement that is already starting to fracture in the last few years.
Well, that's part of the criticism of Obama, that he wanted to work through those international organizations to try to bring those disparate sides together. And 45, Trump doesn't seem interested in the international organizations and is going to go it either unilaterally or bilaterally to do the same thing. Maybe. I mean, that's part of the part of the problem of not having at least some, even a vague policy. I want to talk again, because this is another difference between Obama, I think, and Trump, and that is the tactical side of things. In other words, you already mentioned that Trump wanted to show how tough he was, and so boom, he bombs some of Assad's assets in Syria, and yet, so some people. This is a, we have a 45-minute show, so this is, we're supposed to step back here and say, you know, this isn't the way to stability and peace in the Middle East. That these tactical transactional things that stabilizing societies, hospitals, governments that have a structure, and all of the things that and that people need to survive, so that society needs to thrive, you know, schools and hospitals and things. Those are the issues that the U.S. should be and Russia should be dealing with, not who gets bombed next, or do we send in troops from Syria? Do we send in troops? Do we send ground troops into Syria? And so on. So it's all military. Your book is on the military-civilian interface. How do we get past the military that everybody understands and recognizes and get to the real issues that people need and care about in order to have a stable Middle East?
Well, first and foremost, there needs to be the actual political will to do so.
There you go.
And there isn't, right now, there isn't in the region that political will, because it's more lucrative for these countries to, and these leader, the leaders of these countries to continue to fight, because they're getting support from larger actors who see a value in having these conflicts go on.
I see. Right.
So everybody's pouring money into Syria in support of certain allies, and then that just that aggravates the whole situation.
Yes.
And so you have a state, folks, that, you know, obviously the people from the different, we call them tribes of the state, are at war with each other. And then you have foreign powers throwing a ton of money and armaments into the situation, and you end up with 50 million refugees or whatever it is, and a pretty much destroyed state. I guess what people don't know is how you get to a civil society from that.
Right.
Or maybe there's no way. I mean, I don't know. In the Lebanon, people just got tired of killing each other, and the country stabilized. You had the same kind of tribal fighting.
While you're thinking of that, we want to mention our tribe here at Democratic Perspective. We have the wonderful support offshore of El Portal. And Steve Segner and his crew over there are good supporters of Democratic Perspective. We have Democrats of the Red Rocks who have continued their fine support of our show. And please go to their wonderful breakfast that are really getting incredible attendance. They have their breakfast every month at the Old Sedona Bar and Grill, and they have some wonderful speakers. I think Paul has been one of them over the years. Then, like I say, they are the heightened, if nothing else, the heightened interest in things political have allowed Democrats of the Red Rocks to play a larger and larger role in things, and certainly bringing information to Sedona and the Verde Valley.
The next door breakfast is the 18th, and I believe there's a political organizer coming in and talking about how you get from here to there. I mean, that's the issue. In other words, if you
how do you go from intention to action? If you're angry at 45, what can you do about it? Or if you think Arizona schools ought to have not be 52nd in funding, you know, Guam should have nothing against Guam, but maybe Arizona should have a higher rate of support for their education than some places. Then this guy will tell you how to do it.
People like to talk about their opinions, and I think that's very important that people have views and these things. But there's also a tactical element to all of this. I mean, there's tactics in the Middle East. There's a big, that most Americans, I don't think, see a big proxy fight between Iran and Saudi Arabia and its allies,
right,
between the Sunni part of Islam and the Shiite part. All over the Middle East, we see it in Yemen, we see it in Syria. Can you talk to that?
Well, you know, there's not enough time in the remaining time in this radio show to talk about that conflict. It's such a broad historical conflict. But what I can speak to is the fact that, you know, the Saudis represent, as the major power representing Sunni interests in Iran being the major Shia power. You know, they want power. They want influence. They want to be able to dictate the course of events, in the region.
So is this classic, I mean, it's, the guise is religion, but it's basically a power struggle for influence?
I think so. Yes, I think it started as, you know, a religious conflict, but it's turned more with the influence of colonialism, the influence of the Cold War and modern politics, is that it's turned more into a desire for power, power and influence. Realpolitik in the terms of Henry Kissinger.
So what's happening in Yemen? We seem to be drawn in, apparently, at least there's feelers out from the Trump administration to become more involved in Yemen. And it's hard for Americans to see what interest we have at all in this conflict and why we would side, with Sunnis instead of Shia.
The reason is because Yemen has become a failed state, and it's been historically since 9/11 one of the largest breeding grounds for Islamic fundamentalist terrorism. And so that's why the Obama administration has engaged, or it did engage in a larger drone warfare to go after members of Al-Qaeda, because the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen was one of the largest organizers of terrorist attacks outside of the Middle East.
They sent the shoe bomber?
The shoe bomber, right. Mm-hmm. And then sending affiliates into Europe, cells within Europe. But then there's also the ethnic disagreements between the Yemenis themselves. You know, another issue that we can't go into right now because of, you know, the remaining time. But the important thing to remember is that the Saudis are supporting, you know, the Sunni elements, the Iranians supporting the Houthis, which are an ethnic group within that country. And so the United States is in agreement with the Saudis because they are our major ally in the region.
But should we support? I mean, this is a age-old conflict, ethnic conflict within Yemen, and Yemen has gone through a complex process. There was a time when I knew Yemenis diplomats at the UN, and Yemen was divided between North and South Yemen, and now it's divided basically ethnic. We have an interest maybe in attacking Al-Qaeda, but what's our interest in supporting these massive Saudi bombings and siding with Saudi Arabia in a civil war that it doesn't seem to have any implications for us?
Well, because
I
think it does, because it allows us to, you know, indirectly attack Iran. This is an Iranian interest, and since 1979, the United States was declared by Iran as the Great Satan, and so the United States has always, except for a brief period after the 9/11 attacks, has always worked to challenge Iranian interests in the Middle East. And so we see working with the Saudis in Yemen as an opportunity, you know, in this, the whole game of politics, to one-up the Iranians.
To continue that policy of working against Iran's interests.
Right.
So let's summarize. We got Syria. We don't know what deals are being made. It's a complete chaos, but something is we got Iraq is on the verge of maybe some stability as they eliminate ISIS, or at least weaken them. We have Yemen as a failed state. What about? I want to talk about Jordan and what? And Iran just had an election. What does the Iranian election mean? Or is it coming up?
It's coming up.
It's coming up. Yeah.
All right. And Jordan was our ally in the region. Are they in danger of becoming a Yemen? I mean, I
No, Jordan is not. Jordan, the King Abdullah is a strong supporter of the United States, and
yes,
he just recently met with the president here in Washington, And they're going to Jordan is going to continue to they're reliant upon the United States for a huge amount of aid, but they've also taken in the refugees.
Yes, they have.
And it won't become a failed state because actually Abdullah believes in modernity, and he believes in the idea of having the people, you know, have a say, so they're allowed to elect a parliament, but, you know, he's doing gradual reforms.
I see.
What I've read about Jordan is that, you know, he eventually wants Jordan to become a constitutional monarchy, similar to what England is. But
right.
that's many years down the road. But the Jordanian Special Forces will continue to play a role in going after ISIS and working with the United States. And I think, you know, they'll be a major ally for us in the region, to get back to one of the earlier questions of who supports us.
What about Iran? Is Trump going to undo the nuclear deal, which seems stupid? But then again, there's so much stupid. Where's Iran going in all of this? They've been absent from our headlines for a while.
Right. Well, I don't. There was initial talk that Iran and the Iranian framework was going to be dissolved. I know Trump campaigned on that issue, but for right now, you know, the deal is still in place. Nothing
right.
has been changed, and I think, you know, there were some early reports that, you know, Iran had been violating the deal, and that there should be, you know, some new sanctions put in place. But I think there's negotiations that have been going on behind the scenes that we're not privy to.
And there's an election between a moderate president, right, between the sort of arch conservatives in Iran and a more moderate president who supported negotiations. How's that looking? Are we going to have a shift to the right in Iran, or?
Well, all of the candidates are approved by the Grand Ayatollah, and so
yeah. So yeah, when we say liberal,
it's all a relative thing.
Like yes, he is a moderate, and he has widespread support for sure. So I think he'll win re-election, but you know a lot will depend on how the conservative candidate is portrayed in their media. From everything I've read about him and seen about him, he doesn't seem to have as much support as Rouhani does right now, currently.
Well, that's a good thing, I think. Iran's trying to improve its economic situation. It's working
sure.
hard to do that.
And that's why they ended up signing the framework deal in the first place,
yeah.
is they needed those sanctions relieved so that they could help their economy.
They've been buying aircraft to modernize their I guess they had a 20-year-old civilian aircraft industry or fleet, and they've been buying aircraft. They're trying
sure.
to improve their train system. They're trying to improve their roads. They're trying to, well, you know, what we should do is work on infrastructure too. But, you know, I mean, that they're putting some investments in that.
I don't think we can do a whole show on the Middle East without at least mentioning Israel. A lot of information coming out of Gaza. And the injustices of Gaza. We did a show on a lady wrote a book about the injustices of the Gaza Strip. We'd love to hear Paul Lynn's talk about that.
What aspect would you like me to
talk
about?
Is there going to be some solution? And we got the West Bank, we got the Gaza Strip, we got the settlements. So I guess, you know, Trump supports the settlements. So is that it? That's end of story. The settlements will continue, and there never will be any peace.
And Hamas has made a little gesture toward being more moderate. But nobody knows what that means, I don't think.
Right. There's been that they will agree to recognize the land that Israel had acquired since 1948. But I think that, no, there won't be peace in the Middle East anytime soon as far as the Arab-Israeli conflict. Because Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, you know, his whole campaign issue was, you know, Eretz Israel, greater Israel. And so the settlements are a key component of that. So I think you're going to continue to see, you know, the occasional rocket attack from Islamic Jihad. And you're going to continue to see the State of Israel say that, no, we are not going to negotiate with you Palestinians because you are unwilling to work towards peace.
It's the conditions in the Gaza Strip, I think, that...
Oh, it's horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. And, I believe the Palestinians should have a state. The problem is that often in the historical framework of that conflict, yes. you had the leader saying one thing publicly and then turning around and supporting groups like Islamic Jihad, you know, and Hamas using terrorism against the Israelis.
That's harder to do now, I think, than it was back in the day to say one thing, and of course, in the Middle East, this is the way things are. Everybody says one thing and does another. But it's harder to do it on the down low, I think. And that's one of the Israel is out there, said, we want to have a greater Israeli state, even if it includes what may be. And even when you say words like traditional Palestinian homeland, people say, well, there's no such thing as a Palestinian. What do they mean by that, by the way? You know, that Palestine didn't exist. It was, and so when you say, well, let's go back, let's have the two-state solution, well, there's only one state. Even the Arab world doesn't necessarily recognize a Palestinian state to reorganize.
Well, the Arab world, you know, agrees that the Palestinians are the people, the Arab or Palestinian Arabs who live in this region, you know, that is, that was known as Palestine for a time.
Right.
I'm talking way prior to the time of the creation of Israel, prior to World War I, talking in the 1800s and even earlier, that the ethnic group that was there was Palestinian Arab. You know, you had Jews that lived there as well, but you also had, in the various migrations over the course of history, right. Jews coming from Russia and from Eastern right. Europe. So I think the state of Israel, you know, is responding to the fact that you have a movement of people who were unable to organize initially, you know, and they were able to use the fact that they were able to influence the British to support them, they were able to create their state, whereas the Palestinians had a lack of leadership. There was a lot of tribal infighting among the Arabs living there that caused them to be viewed as an other and were the subject of attacks. You know, and I think that helped to create the instability that you're seeing.
Will there be another intifada? I mean, they're building more and more settlements. They're being more, well, we've got 2 minutes left. They're being more obvious about repression. I guess instead of answering that question, tell us again about the name of your book and where people can get it and when you're writing on. We're talking with Professor Paul Linz of the NAU Political Science Department.
The name of the book is Civil Military Relations in the Islamic World. It's available on Amazon. You can just type in my name, and it'll come up. And then the second book, is going to be on the Syrian refugees. And right now the tentative title is Europe Has No Statue of Liberty, Forced Migration and Infectious Diseases and the European Union's Response.
Wow. That's a cheery topic, right, Mike?
Well, yeah, that's
somebody's got to do it, you know.
I was going to be at the top of the show. I was going to try to say, you know, we're going to try not to depress the crap out of you in this. But talking about the Middle East it's hard not to, because there so are few rays of sunshine. Someday we'll do a show. Does Israel have a responsibility to create a Palestinian state, you know, and therefore have stability, at least in their own region? That's will be the topic of another show. Don't forget, we had Paul Linz this morning. Paul Linz from NAU. We talked about the Middle East just as a sort of a Trump break. And we want to talk about this show, and all our shows are on vvid.org. You can find the podcasts for this show and all our wonderful shows on vvid.org. And we don't forget our show on Saturday at 12:15. This show will be rebroadcast. We have started a twice-a-week show. Democratic Perspective is on Saturday at 12:15. Please tune in at that time. Thanks, folks.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news and our Saturday replay after the noon news right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.